Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Phil Klein, author of Missionaries, published by Penguin this month. We last spoke with Phil in 2014, about his collection of short stories, Redeployment, which, as you know, won the National Book Award and one of the 10 best books of 2014 by the New York Times. He's written a great deal of nonfiction as well, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Atlantic, New Yorker. The fog of war has become a misunderstood term, much like irony. The fog of war strictly means the uncertainty and situational awareness experienced by participants in military operations. But most of us see it more as an example of like that Robert McNamara video of a complete understanding of who's right, who's wrong, and what's the purpose of one's own actions, much as in what became of Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. So I'll use the improper definition as a starting off point here, as I will with irony. In Redeployment, this fog is not so dense because we're generally dealing with individuals that are speaking of their own personal experiences. In Missionaries, in a novel that is picaresque in a way, we're tracking a band of characters from continent to continent, war to war. The fog is very thick. You know, what is a good war? What is a war that we're winning? Who's fighting? Who is good? Who is bad? Who's right? Who is wrong? Or does it even matter? So we meet a score of characters, all well-drawn, but our main protagonist is Lizette, a kind of junkie drawn to war for many reasons. Abolito is a man who never really grows up and pays several prices, both for his naivete and his weaknesses. Mason is a kind of man in the middle, himself in his own little fog. And I could go on, as I always do, describing Juan Pablo with Jefferson and so many others, but it's time to get to work. So welcome, Phil, and it's nice to be talking to you again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be chatting about the book. Thanks.
So the two books you've written deal with war in two different ways. One from a micro kind of lens, Missionaries, and a very macro vista. Am I right in this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the book starts with these kind of individual narratives, almost like sort of little novellas from the perspective of four different characters, right? And they're sort of depiction of themselves and their role in different conflicts around the world and their relationship to American wars and the American extension of power. But then it broadens to a much larger canvas. And, you know, I think one of the things that drove me to write the book was, and to write it in this way specifically, is, we often talk about our wars, our American wars, as these discrete things. Right? The war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, our involvement in Colombia, our involvement in the Philippines, our involvement in the war in Yemen, right? And yet, if you look at the way that American power operates around the world and the way that sort of different technologies of war and even the same people move around, that those distinctions start to blur. Maybe it's that part of that sort of metaphorical fog of war that you're talking about. You know, when you can have a Colombian mercenary in an Emirati airbase who is watching a Houthi tribesman in Yemen over a Chinese-made drone before killing him with an American missile, right? You're talking about a globalized network of violence and system of war that expands beyond one country and one specific conflict. But how do you describe that? And how do you do that without violating something that's very important, I think, to any writing about war, which is what David Jones, the great World War I poet, talked about making the writing incarnational, right? Sort of taking the reader down into the sort of direct human experience of war. How do you do that while also talking about these much broader and almost sort of abstract systems of violence that get employed? And the way that I tried to do that was to put these characters into a novel. You have characters who start in Iraq, characters who start in Afghanistan, characters in Colombia, and you can sort of see the ways in which there are these kind of interconnections and cross-pollinations between the different wars.
So one way of getting at it, and you know, I own a bookstore, so everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but everyone who comes in does judge a book by its cover, and there's right there. And the covers, these fighter jets, I don't know, are they like supposed to be like F-24s, or are they supposed to be like a specific plane, or you just took a plane?
I didn't do the cover. I think they did a fantastic job with the cover, but I you know, I'm not, I didn't design it myself. But yeah, they look like fighter planes.
Well, so, and then the top, as you can see there, is a bird. And of course, if you look at it just like that, you look like, okay, this is war leading to the dove of peace or something like that. But I don't read the book that way. But it is an excellent cover. So my point is, it's because I own a bookstore, because it's not going to be on the front table, or it is on the front table, people, I think, will like the book. They'll definitely pick it up. It's great. The yellow is great. Blank.
Yeah.
But that leads me to the epigraph, though, because I'm interested in epigraphs, because I assume authors spend a lot of time trying to find the words. And this is where irony comes in. The epigraph is, report us fairly how we slaughter for the common good, which is Seamus Heaney from his poem Kinship. And if you look at that straightforwardly, and this is what the issue I always have with you is, like, are you telling me that it's okay, like at the end, let me just look at the end when Juan Pablo is at his last mission site, and he says, you know, oh, look at all those children dying. It's unfortunate. And so is that what you're saying, that, you know, do you want us to forgive? Do you want the reader to forgive? Is that what the epigraph is saying?
No. Report us fairly how we slaughter for the common good. I mean, there's quite a bit of irony in that line. And even the level of the sound, you know, the word slaughter. And this is Seamus Heaney addressing Tacitus, right? From the perspective of the Romans. And, you know, that's from his great poem, Kinship. And there's this real concern there with, you know, to start talking in the natural landscape, these kind of, this organic, earthy connection to culture and to the past, to histories of violence, but also the way that violence sort of intrudes on organic communities and cultures and destroys them, right? And so one of the concerns with the book is, you know, over the past two decades, right, in theory, what we have learned as you know, as we've watched these wars progress, is the limits of what you can do with violent power, the absolute necessity of, if you're going to try and interact with another country, including violently, of employing other types of American power, diplomatic, economic, understanding the social context and the cultural context can be determinative for whether or not, you know, you're sort of pushing things in a good, more stable direction or not. That's what we've learned, that we've seen time and time again, the limits of what you can do simply with violence. What we've built, though, over the past two decades, is a highly sophisticated system for killing people around the world, right? And we've let tools of American soft power, like, you know, just if you look at the State Department, is the sort of most glaring and obvious example of that. We let those tools wither, right? And so oftentimes what we are doing is we're trying to effect changes in regions that we don't fully understand using the blunt tool of violence, right? And what does that do? What does that do when it's seen from the ground level? And the way that the novel is structured, there are four main characters that we start out with. Adele is from this poor rural region in a province called Norte de Santander in Colombia on the Venezuelan border. And so, you know, we get him at this sort of very much closer to the ground level. Then there's Juan Pablo, who is a Colombian special forces officer, right? We get a sort of Mason, who is a American soldier in the special forces, right, who interacts with and is a sort of liaison with Juan Pablo, right? Mason representing U.S. interests, Juan Pablo representing the interests of the Colombian military. And, you know, above that, we have Lizette, a reporter who starts out in Afghanistan, is sort of trying to look at things from a bird's eye view and make sense of these new American wars. And so the novel is structured to sort of bring all these people together so that we can see what happens at each level as institutions designed to do violence are doing their thing. And you know, that in those institutions become highly sophisticated. So if you look at something like targeted killing, just targeted killing alone, right, which, you know, tends to make headlines and is the sort of thing that presidents brag about, right? During the RNC, Donald Trump bragged about having killed Qasem Soleimani. In Obama's last State of the Union address, he bragged about having killed Osama bin Laden, taking out the guy who planned the Benghazi raid. You know, we as Americans like those narratives, right? Or at least they're viewed as politically successful, whether or not they relate to actually real progress on the ground militarily. So if you look at how targeted killing has evolved, in 2004 in Iraq, Joint Special Operations Command was doing about 12 raids a month, right? By 2006, they're doing about 250. That's not because the Navy SEALs went to the gym and got, you know, more buff and more worthy of writing memoirs. It's because the system behind them changed, the system by which we tie together not just new technologies and direct action units like the SEALs, but intelligence services and the sort of whole apparatus of military power, of intelligence that allows us to rapidly generate targets and then act on that information. So that system is extremely lethal. If you look at, say, Navy SEALs or, you know, Delta Force or special operations teams, most people think they're kind of cool. If you look at drones killing people from, you know, a device in the sky, most people think they're kind of creepy. But the drone and the special forces guy, or the special operations guy, those are just the flathead and Phillips head screwdriver at the end of a targeting system. That system is extremely lethal, and that system we've applied around the world. So in Colombia, we helped Colombia start killing leaders of various guerrilla groups, right? And they did the killing, right, at the end stage, but we were intimately involved in providing them with assistance, providing them with electronic signals intelligence, and also with providing them with know-how and helping them develop their skills at doing the same sorts of things that we do. And so, you know, and that's just a sort of, in a microcosm, a small example of how things that happen in one theater sort of migrate to another. And it becomes very, very easy for militaries to reach out and kill somebody in a region. But controlling the consequences of that and ensuring that the effects on the region where we're doing violence are actually to the good, that is a much more complicated, complicated thing.
Well, staying with what you're, the way you're talking about it in such a dry way without talking about someone being cut in half with a chainsaw.
Yeah. If you look, seen from the book, yes.
Right. But if you look at the government of Colombia, you got far right paramilitary groups, crime syndicates, guerrilla groups, Revolutionary Armed Forces, FARC, the National Liberation Army, the Popular Liberation Army. And in the book, you know, I'm not going to pronounce all these right. Cocaleras, guerrillas, parracos, right. Bandits, police, soldiers. So here am I. And you did this in some of your other interviews about what am I supposed to say either to the soldiers returning, mm-hmm. you know, hey, I can't imagine what it must have felt like, or thanks for your service. But here, Americans are going in, I have no idea who's right. Mm-hmm. Like 10 groups, I have no idea who's right, why we're there, what our goals are, and how, you can't explain that to me. Can you explain that to me? Who's right? Good guys.
Well, I mean, I don't think that there's a clear good guy, right? I can certainly explain to you the different sort of institutional incentives of the people, right? Like if you're a guy in the special forces, right, and you're looking at how business is done, what you think makes sense, what options you have available to you, right? That I can talk about. You know, if you're Avel in this region, what are the choices that he's presented with in this world that he's grown up in, right? What are the dangers that he needs to navigate as well as the opportunities? What are the incentives for the various actors? I don't think it's so easy. I mean, certainly there are definitely bad guys in the book who, you know, you wouldn't call, for example, the character named Jefferson, who is a fairly, I think, evil figure. It's safe to say.
How did you pick the name Jefferson?
it seemed to fit. And occasionally, you know, you will, you know, be out in a very, you know, you'll find people with names like, you know, named after American founding fathers, right? Or sort of dramatic figures from history. And Jefferson just seemed like, it felt right. I don't want to sort of go through the whole process. You know, sometimes as you're going through and you're sort of thinking like, what should this character be named? It just seemed to make sense. And I think it was the right call. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. And you know, me, I don't like to, I mean, you have a narrative and it's the right narrative, but I always take you away by asking these extraneous questions. So it's interesting how the West comes into the book through movies, and specifically like Sylvester Stallone and Steven Seagal.
Right.
It seems, at first it seems like a little thing, but when you think about it, it's kind of a really big thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that?
Well, yeah, you know, I think that, again, I was talking about the importance of kind of cultural factors in determining things. So, you know, I was a Marine in Iraq in 2007, and we did this huge surge, right? Increased numbers of troops in Iraq. And there was a huge decline in violence during the time that I was there, but that never would have happened had there not been a kind of homegrown, political and social movement known as the Anbar Awakening that was reacting to events going on in Anbar in ways that were very different sometimes than the Americans like to portray them as, right? And so we experienced what we thought of as great success in 2007 and 2008 because the social and political considerations for the people there changed dramatically. And then when that the social and political and cultural factors changed again, all those gains sort of evaporated, and you had the rise of ISIS. And so these sort of, you know, Clausewitz always talks about the moral factors in war, right? As being incredibly important. And especially in wars like the ones that we are continually engaged in, these kind of messy, asymmetric wars, wars where you have actors who sort of blur the line between criminality and political actor, and sort of, in some ways, some of these groups, you know, so, you know, we talked about Jefferson. When we first meet him, he's the head of a sort of right-wing paramilitary group, right? But he's also sort of more of a government figure in the region that he operates than the government is, right? And his men provide a kind of rough justice. They levy taxes. You know, they do all sorts of functions as a kind of parasitic and brutal government, essentially. And they also provide some social services to try and get people on board with them, or they siphon funds from the government that that are going to social services and take credit for them. And so, you know, those kind of cultural and social factors are critical, and the permeability of kind of everything in this world, whether it's, you know, the kind of globalization of war or of just kind of American pop culture. And yeah, there's a sort of bit that recurs with movies, and Jefferson is in terms of, you know, Sylvester Stallone versus Steve Seagal. Jefferson is a Steve Seagal kind of guy.
Yeah, and I remember the exact scene from the movie that you described, and also the scene in the bar where he takes everybody out. And that's Jefferson, which with this really broad brush, and notwithstanding the fact that he's, in my opinion, despicable, there's this little part of you that kind of admires him in this strange way. especially in certain situations, which I won't spoil. But yeah, he has a certain bravery. He has a certain generosity. He's really a really bad guy, but.
And he's smart. He's no fool. Though he's depraved in many ways, yeah.
Yeah, and again, how do you pronounce is Abel Abel Valenz Abuelito? Abuelito?
Abuelito, yeah.
And so Abuelito becomes his not his lackey, not his servant, not his slave, but he becomes theoretically his right hand man or the little thumb or whatever on his right hand. And how did you come up with that? How did you come up with the idea of someone who was, he's not a bad guy at all. He liked to be good and he tries to be good and he tries to put the past behind it. But
yeah, so he sort of, we start out with Abuelito and right. His whole family is massacred. And he survives and is essentially homeless for a little while and then is taken in by a little gang that is associated with the paramilitaries, right? And so that's his only place to sort of exist in the world because the place that he came from, the place that had provided him with, you know, everything that he was, is just wiped away. It's destroyed. And so he rises up in the ranks of the paramilitaries, but not because he's really good at violence, but he ends up almost being like the civil affairs guy for Jefferson, where they'll have these little side projects that they do in the towns, and they have a lot of interaction with local mayors and political players because the paramilitaries are a political organization, right? And he shows a facility with that sort of thing. He's smart. And Jefferson sees that and makes him into, you know, sort of one of his, you know, the paramilitary in his organization who primarily handles that sort of thing. But understanding sort of social and political context is related to the violence they do too. So there's a congressional election in the early part of this millennium where after the election, Jefferson sends him out to look through, you know, which town voted for which political party, right? And this is something that actually happened. The political scientist, Abby Steele, has a wonderful book on this in the ways that paramilitary groups used electoral data to figure out actually what communities to target. And so in advance of the presidential election, there's a town that had voted sort of the wrong way politically, or the way that the paramilitaries didn't want. And so the goal is to essentially do a kind of campaign of terror until that town is utterly disappeared.
Yeah. And that goes back to, I guess, when you write about war, whether, you know, and to me, you know, from 1968, well, and the book covers from the 80s to 2016. But for me, being a hippie in 1969 and protesting against the Vietnam War and then not understanding the Iraqi war because they didn't knock down the World Trade Centers, they had no weapons of mass destruction, they had no yellow cake, but we had Dick Cheney. And we could get oil and we could make a lot of money off of it. But I never hear from you in the interviews. And I know it's not really right to talk to you about this in the sense that I'm not saying, I don't know. What I'm saying is, what do you actually think about the value, if there is any, of any of these wars, whether it's Grenada, Nicaragua, or going up San Juan Hill?
Right.
Possible purpose, you know, it's like, or what is it good for? You go back to the Temptations, you know? So what is it for? What is war good for?
Well, so I would say this, I'm not a pacifist, right? I do think that there is a role for the military, and certainly, you know, if you're Juan Pablo, who's a complicated character, right? My Colombian special forces guy. If you're him, you know, pacifism is not an option because there's a war going on in this country, right? And it's, you know, so the question then is how do you respond to it? What do you do when there are sort of various actors? You know, it's easy enough to say that we pull out of a place, right? But I was in Iraq in December, and I met with refugees from Syria, who almost universally were all refugees because of Trump's sort of semi-abortive pullout of Syria, right? So he sort of said he was pulling out all the troops from Syria, but then he left some in. But in the areas where he did pull out American troops, which was a very small number of troops, Turkish-backed militias moved in, brutalized the population there. I remember talking with a Syrian refugee who's a Kurd. You know, he had pins in his legs where he'd been injured in a rocket strike. He's living in a tent. His wife is pregnant. He's got two kids, and he's furious that the Americans pulled out their small troop presence in that region because it left them to the depredations of these Turkish militias. Now that's not an argument sort of from Washington that, you know, we need to stay in Syria, but you know, whether or not we should have troops in Syria needs to be part of a sort of comprehensive strategy for the region, which we don't have. We don't have anything even close to it. But, you know, it's fairly obvious. Like, what is the point of having troops abroad? You check the actions of other military actors, right? Some of whom are quite vicious. Now, the problem comes where you can have a situation like that that makes sense. You can have a situation like sort of President Obama was faced with in during the rise of ISIS. So he had pulled troops out of Iraq. He had been elected in part as a anti-war candidate, or at least a candidate who was opposed to the Iraq war. He later did a sort of disastrous surge to Afghanistan. And then you have Iraq sort of completely unraveling under his watch. And you know, if you've got ISIS fighters moving out to Mount Sinjar, where they're committing genocide and enslaving Yazidi women and girls by the thousands and committing mass rape, I certainly understand dropping airstrikes on those units, right? And aiding the Peshmerga and pushing back ISIS, right? That doesn't seem to be a particularly hard moral call for me. The problem is, what ended up happening in the Obama administration was there are all these sort of little discrete things that made sense in isolation like that, right? And what we ultimately got was a scattershot military policy where we were steadily ramping up military involvement in Iraq, but not in a way that seemed to make any kind of coherent sense in sort of a broader policy. And so we're doing one thing in Yemen and another thing in Iraq and another thing in Syria. The policies don't really mesh together because in some way, they're brought up as a kind of whack-a-mole, deal with the sort of put out fires kind of thing. And I think that if you're going to be killing people abroad, it needs to be part of a much more serious strategy that can justify not just sending American soldiers into harm's way, but also killing people, right? Because the consequences of violence can rapidly spiral out of control. It creates second and third order effects that can be devastating. And I don't think that we think seriously enough about how we're employing force. We like to localize the violence into little discrete stories that make sense to us, right? Killing of Qasem Soleimani is a perfect point. You know, it was sold to us as checking Iran, but it was done in Iraq at a time when Iran was under a lot of pressure because there were anti-Iranian protests in Iraq because Iranian-backed militias had fired on and killed hundreds of protesters, right, who were protesting corruption and various things in the government. And then in this moment, we kill Soleimani, we kill the head of a Iranian-backed militia. Right now, you have intensified Iranian militia activity in Iraq, groups that feel empowered by what happened, And you have the State Department threatening to withdraw from the American embassy because the situation has gone so totally out of control. And this particular strike is sold as a success to us, right? That it being sold as a success is, I think, because it feels good to people to kill a guy like Qasem Soleimani, who, look, totally evil guy, right? But it's not thought of in terms of a broader policy that would justify the exercise of military power in a country that we as Americans aren't paying that much attention to, see increasingly less sort of strategic interest in, and frankly don't understand.
Well, two things then. And what I want to do is try and bring it back to the specific human level. Like when we kill him or kill any terrorist and we pretend that there's no collateral damage because the bomb directly on the top of his head kills him and not his kids, not his uncle, not his grandfather. And I remember the one story about this kid, well, I don't know, 12 members of his family were killed. He was injured. He was flown to Great Britain. If I was that kid, when I grew up, what would I want to do? There is nothing I would want to do more than kill as many Americans as I could. That would be my job in my life. That would be my goal in my life. And that's what I'm trying to get to is, what you're talking like what might an article that might be contained in Foreign Affairs Quarterly or something. And I'm talking about, okay, let's go to the scene. What the scene is not gratuitous. You're talking about a guy on a car while his daughter's watching, who's very important in the book, and he's cut in half with a chainsaw. So your point, and lots of places where someone's, and in the last book too, where someone's reaching into somebody's gut and feels their aorta. This is what war is.
Right. And that's why I think that putting it in a novel is important because, if you leave out that physical, visceral immediacy of the thing, if it's just the kind of foreign policy analysis, right, you're missing not just the emotional context, but the sort of emotional weight of it and the physical immediacy of it is a large point of a part of what we have to understand in order to understand what it means when these things happen, and what kinds of consequences they can have.
But take, for example, Juan Carlos in his last gig, where you're talking about, and you name them all, the different weaponry, which is fascinating to me because it's like it's science fiction. And he's basically a mercenary. He doesn't care in the slightest. Like when he says regrettable, but there's no emotion. He loves his daughter. He doesn't seem like a bad person. But when he goes there, it's just a job, and he's getting paid a lot of money to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
What are you trying to tell us? That's not war. It's just one man deciding, this is the way I'm going to act for the rest of my life. But it's going to involve killing a lot of people at the same time.
Right. So one of the characters ends up as a mercenary in Yemen. And that end of the book does, to sort of talk about, when you talk about the different technology, the real, interconnectedness of war. You have a brutal war in Yemen fought with weapons that could never have been built there, right? And there's a passage, I'll just sort of read a couple sentences, where he's looking over a screen through a drone at troops going through. The armored vehicles could have come from almost anywhere in the civilized world. He'd seen American Max Pro and Oshkosh MATVs here, but also Finnish Patriots, South African RGs, even French Leclerc tanks, though he couldn't make any of those out on the screens before him. If the resolution was good enough to make out individual weapons, he knew he'd see representatives of even more countries. Singaporean 120mm mortars, Serbian Zastava machine guns, Belgian FN minis, Chinese M80s, and an assortment of small arms and heavy ordnance from Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Brazil, and more. The buildings they were destroying were made of local stone or soil mixed with straw or burn mud.
But it was a wedding.
Oh, yeah. Well, so that earlier they strike a wedding. Yeah.
And he's watching them go to another building, but we're...
And so there you have this sort of highly technologized, abstract, war making where, you know, the people immediately directing the violence are utterly removed from that, then they just won't need to see what they're doing.
If I go back to, well, first, Full Metal.
And also just the kind of globalized, you know, economic system that is a part of this.
But then you drill down to other aspects of war, like in Full Metal Jacket, where the Joker says, how can you kill women and children? And he goes, you just lead them a little, you know, just lead them a little less. Ain't war hell? And that's what I'm talking about. Or when in Apocalypse Now, Colonel Kurtz, because he's become what he has become, he admires the precision, the diamond-like precision of the soldiers who cut off the arms of the little kids that were just inoculated against polio. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm trying to get from you. You're talking about in terms of strategy as almost as if it's a chess game. And it's not that you ignore it because it's in your book all over, but how can you reconcile, and you say you're not a pacifist, how can you reconcile that type of, we are not, this is not about us policing the world and making it a better place. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to believe that, but it's not about that. So, and I don't mean to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, but really basically, I just want to know what it's all about. If we were trying to become an empire, makes perfect sense. If we were trying mm-hmm. to rule the world, all this makes perfect sense. Might be good or bad, but that would explain what we do.
But I think we're in an intermediate state. Right, where we're sort of a not quite empire, right? Where we are all over the place, but we can't really admit it to ourselves. Each character has their own sort of ideological justification for what they're doing and what they're trying to doing and how they're trying to influence their own institutions, right? That they're a part of. And that are a part of war making. And so you kind of get very different sensibilities from, you know, the four main characters, but also from somebody like Louisa, who becomes sort of works in the community and works with victims of the violence afterwards and has to navigate in a space where she's trying to help former participants in the war, people who've been victimized by the war, in a place where conflict has not exactly ended, right? And where some of the same violent actors sort of cycle back through. And her, you know, what drives her is going to be very different from what drives somebody like Juan Pablo or from an American soldier like Mason.
Why does Lizette want to go to a place where we're winning a war?
Lizette has been in Afghanistan and has burned out, and she wants to go to some place she wants to go to a good war, right? She wants to go to some place where she can feel good about what American military might has done. And Colombia is sold to her as that place because the FARC was a, you know, the novel is set and, you know, goes to 2016. And that's when there was this, you know, historic peace accord that was signed with the FARC, this, you know, the longest running insurgency in the world. And one of the reasons that was signed was because the FARC had suffered a series of crushing military defeats that came on the heels of a large package of military aid that started at the end of the Clinton administration called Plan Colombia, which actually Joe Biden helped put together. And so, the Colombian government, headed by Álvaro Uribe, who is currently in actually quite a bit of legal trouble because of his ties to violent paramilitary groups and other things, started this push against the FARC, right? And we aided them with various things, most notably with attack helicopters, right? And air assault assets, which in a kind of country with jungles and mountains is extremely important. And initially it was only for the drug war, which was a total failure. But during the Bush years, that got shifted to allow them to just use it for the general war against the FARC and the ELN. And so there was a period with a lot of violence, and then the level of sort of violent death in Colombia went dramatically down, right, from where it had been. And so if you were looking at the war, you would think like, look, like there's a lot less violent death in Colombia right now, and they're about to sign a peace treaty, right? So this is the place that she wants to go to look at on the eve of this peace treaty and think about how that was created and what it has to say about other wars, because Colombia is a model that we tried to export elsewhere, right? So in two of our ambassadors to Colombia, their next posting was to be the ambassador to Afghanistan from the United States, right? And one of them, William Wood, later said that of all the places that he'd served, there was nowhere where there was more going on than Colombia, and he included Afghanistan in that.
Okay. So the last, the only good war that I know of is World War II, because it was a war that had to be fought. It was a good war in that we were trying to save the world from a despot who would have destroyed it. That was a good war. And but I can't think of a good war since then. And I think you're saying there are, but I can't see Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan was bombed into dust by the Soviets before we even got there.
Part of the narrative of the novel is to find the Colombian concept is a lot more complicated than it is sold to her, right? So the idea that Colombia is the good war I felt that people would read that with a certain degree of irony.
And that's why at the beginning I talked about the misinterpretation of the Falkland mm-hmm. War and irony, and the irony of the epigraph for that matter. Mm-hmm. But how does irony really play into this picture? I mean,
I'll say this because, you know, I think that sometimes with war writers, people expect them to write sort of a more straightforwardly anti-war account, right?
Right.
Or to have more brutality, right? I mean, and I could have made the actors in this a lot more brutal, right? I could have made Mason less thoughtful. I could have made Juan Pablo have a less, you know, have a much more brutish sensibility, and I could have patterned them off of real people if I wanted to. But I think the issue is, for me as a war writer, it is more important to me, you know, I think it's easy to depict a brute doing brutish things, right? And to say, look, war is bad. I think it is more useful to, or more interesting to me, and certainly more troubling, to look at people who I think are genuinely trying to do good. Right. And they're also self-interested. And sometimes the line between sort of, you know, their ideals and their self-interests and the lies that they're telling themselves, those things kind of get blurred. And I wanted to show you like how there are these sort of structures, right, that these people are a part of, and institutions that these people are a part of that have their own incentives and their own kind of inertia to them, right, their own kind of momentum. And that you can have real tragedy emerge out of people who are not brutes, right? Who are thoughtful, who are intelligent, who are, you know, trying to create a more stable order, right? But interacting within structures that are no longer conducive to that, right? Or that are sort of shaping the world violently in ways that are troubling. It would be much, I think in some ways that's more interesting to me, because it's, you know, there's identifying bad actors, but then there's identifying the sort of structures that are shaping global war right now, right? And I wanted to keep my eye on those things. And I also just found it more interesting to have characters who were sort of, you know, had kind of richer and subtler minds than simple Britishness. Because, I mean, a lot of these people are not, and a lot of, you know, most people try to do good. They try to see in their work, you know, that they're doing something meaningful. they're often quite knowledgeable about their own professions and able to speak very eloquently, as I think Juan Pablo can, about why they're doing, you know, why they're doing what they're doing, what they're doing, what they're doing. They're able to critique their own institutions, right? Everybody has those. And yet I wanted to see how they fit into this new way of war, which I think is distinctly different. I think we're in a new phase of military conflict. And I think that the America's role and the sort of global role in that conflict is different. And I think just showing brutishness would be utterly insufficient for being able to look at that. I thought it should be harder for people to grapple with.
Well, especially since, and given the passage that you wrote, and this is going to become even more and more complex and efficient. It is, as we speak. Mm-hmm. So there's not going to be any more American boots on the ground, or be very, very, very difficult to establish that politically, to send 1,000 or 10,000 American kids, 18 years old, into war, unless we were at risk, which we haven't been. And so to go back to Robert McNamara, or if you go back to the idea of fog of war, is there somewhere along this line a lack of situational awareness? Like a redeployment at the very beginning, you're talking about, this guy's talking about killing dogs, and then he goes back and sees his dog. So there must have been a lack of situational awareness for him at one time, because when he comes back, he realizes, and it's really affected him. So there is the fog of war on a small basis. But if he's in Yemen and he's doing this, you're saying, and you wrote it in the sense that he's totally aware, he's totally situationally aware of what he's doing, but you don't come down on him either way.
Well, that's not my job as a writer.
Yeah. Wait, yeah. No, I know.
My job's to create, you know, to create a character in his fullness, you know, and to show you what this looks like and what it feels like, you know, and I think, and then that's all I can do,
well,
you know.
Oh, you're letting me work. I know, and I love. We even talk about not wrapping things up in a gift wrap and tying things up in a bow at the end.
And I don't want to make him too easy for you to dismiss. That's the other thing, because I think sometimes we fool ourselves that the counter argument is weaker than it is, that they're not real concerns out there, right? That they're not real motives driving this. And I think that, you know, you have to put that into your work. You have to. You can't, you know, it's not just that it's bad as a fiction writer to interpret the world too much for the reader, right? It's that you can't develop a valid critique or understanding of anything unless you really dwell with its opposite. I mean, just as a writer in general, the person that I always think of, you know, the writer that I is kind of a lodestar for me is Dostoevsky, right? And what does Dostoevsky do with, you know, his ideological opponents, right? Dostoevsky is a deeply religious writer. He was religious before he went to prison. And used to, I think, critic Belinsky used to say that when he spoke the words Jesus Christ, his face would take on an expression as if he was about to cry. But while he was in prison, he slept with he kept the New Testament under his pillow, and read it over and over. And what does Dostoevsky do? In The Brothers Karamazov, he creates one of the most powerful attacks against God ever put to page, right? Ivan Karamazov's Rebellion and Grand Inquisitor chapter are so powerful, they're inspiring to atheists, to Lev Shestov, to Camus. Why does he do that? Because he doesn't understand what he actually believes until he forces it to grapple with the most rigorous critiques out there, right, in their fullness. And I think that's the job.
It is. Well, look at Crime and Punishment. I mean, yeah. Almost ad nauseum, he's going back and forth between what he did, and even in the beginning, he's not quite sure why he did what he did, and he's not sure whether he feels remorse or not. And
right.
Yeah, and
And there's also the seduction of these ideas that I mean, there's a reason the book is called Missionaries, right?
Right. I understand that. But, okay, this is what happened when I read Redeployment, and I know other people did the same thing. I was reading it as if it was nonfiction for the first. That's good that you can do that, but it's kind of like, oh, geez. And that's why when this book is in one of my book clubs at the bookstore, I call them Fight Club. It's just, they're going to say, how could he do this? And especially the chainsaw scene, they're going to go, why would he do this? Why would he describe this way? And, you know, and so I back off of what I said when you were laughing so hard about me suggesting who Juan Carlos really is. And then it came to mind that, yes, it's not your job. You were right. It's not your job to tell me who he is. Yeah. It's fascinating because I still want to pin you. I still feel like I want to pin you down.
I know. I can feel it.
And then, okay, a way of trying it. And I'm saying this because you've written about it. You have this faith. You have this strong faith in Catholicism.
Yes.
So if Jesus came back and saw what we do, would he turn the other cheek? Would he kick the money changers out of the temple? You know, your bracelets, what would Jesus do? What would he do? How would he respond? Described.
Well, you know, I'll say this. The novel is called Missionaries, right?
Yeah.
Each character has a very strong, ideologically inflected viewpoint, right? One, and they're part of institutions that are reshaping the world. I was talking to a priest this morning, and he was talking about how, he said, you know, in the Gospels, what is the sin that Jesus is always coming back to time and time again? Hypocrisy, especially religious hypocrisy, right? And he goes, you know, in all my years, priest is in his 80s, no one has ever gone into the confessional and said to me, I'm a religious hypocrite.
That's a good point. I could see myself doing that, though.
Well, I got a priest who'd be happy to hear from you.
And I've asked whether I'm in therapy or whether I'm seeing. Well, I was in Key West and there was this fortune teller, and I walked by and he goes, I've read your fortune before. I said, no, you haven't. He goes, yeah, I have. And I said, no, you haven't. But then I got kind of, okay, that's interesting. Let him read that. And the question I asked him was, who am I? And he goes, in all my 30 years of doing this, I've never heard anyone ask that question. And the reason I do it is because, and you must have it too, is there's this commentator that you have that's outside of you.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. That's what, I think that's part of what, people don't listen to one another. And if you saw the debate last night, nobody's really.
Don't remind me, that was.
Well, and that's the thing. Everybody feels the same way, but the upshot of it is just like in war. I mean, okay, this was a shit show. And as I've read six times, the same term over and over again. And these are the two choices we have. And that's not a book. That's the real world. That's what's happening. And you're analyzing this as if there's this group of this majority of people who want to do good. And you may be criticizing Obama, you may not be, you may be criticizing Joe Biden, you may not be, but if you're talking about Trump, there's no agenda there.
Oh yeah, no, it's utterly incoherent. I mean, in many ways, in terms of military policy, he's continued in the things that Obama's done. I think that he's done something truly despicable with his pardons of war criminals, and I think it's actually really, it's dangerous. I think it's something that's dangerous for, you know, even a purely pragmatic level, just the effectiveness of our military, but also its honor, and just deeply disgusting and you know, immoral, just utter abuse of his power in the most vile way.
Yeah, but are you suggesting that there aren't people like him, that there aren't heads of state that are not like him, that are willing to let people die for no particular reason at all?
Well, there clearly are. Yeah. I don't think you can look at my book and say that it's not not aware of that.
I don't know what to make of you. And I still don't know what to make of you. And I didn't the last time I interviewed you about redeployment. Because you know what? In your book, there's people who love war, who love the concept of war. And I don't know whether there's something in you, this is really insulting, and I don't mean, well, no, I guess I do mean to be. It's like, is there a part of that in you? Is there a slight part of that in you that loves the concept of it?
I think you only write out of, I think there's a part of this in all of us, right? I don't think these things, and this is again, one of the reasons why it was important to me to write characters I felt were sort of rich, who you could understand. Because I do think this is something that sort of all of us can understand, right? I think that sometimes we think of kind of making characters empathetic as if you're sort of like justifying them. No, you try to empathetically engage with characters so you can actually fully understand and articulate them in their richness, but then that might not necessarily lead you to approve of them, right? Or excuse them.
And one of the reviews was like implying there's too many characters and all this stuff, and they're not. I mean, and to keep the, you know, the missionary thing, it's almost as if they're apostles in a way. What, Alma especially, Louisa, Sarah, Valencia, there's no way we can get to Uncle Carrie. Oh, it's like, there's no way you can get to them. But what I was saying at the outset is they're so well drawn that each of them serve a particular part. And I think that's what kind of, in one way, drags the reader. And in one way, the reader is able to say, okay, this is almost like a jigsaw puzzle. And I've seen the cover of it. Here's the pieces inside. I mean, look at the cover and put the pieces together. And I think that's a good way of us reconciling our differences.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I like that.